Imagine staging a brilliant play, but hiding your lead actor in the wings until the very final scene. This material is a transdisciplinary, scholarly monograph proposing that human intelligence evolves through a symbolic womb, which is this extended developmental niche spanning from early cooperative care to the emerging integration of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and while the synthesis of evolutionary anthropology and systems theory is incredibly robust, we are jumping straight into the critique today to focus on structural pacing, managing academic caveats, and strengthening the bridge between empirical biology and normative technological ethics.
Right, so let's get right into it. The structural isolation of artificial intelligence into the final sections risks treating large language models as a sudden technological rupture rather than a continuation of the exosomatic evolution established early in the text.
Exactly, because right now the weakness is that the manuscript structurally segregates the biological frameworks, you know, like the evolved nest, cooperative care, and grandmothering, which take up parts 1 through 4, from the technological application of responsive symbolic infrastructure, which is all the way in part 5.
And, I mean, let's look closely at the section discussing exosomatic evolution for a second. Because I completely understand the instinct to build a chronological foundation, right?
Oh, absolutely. You start with early hominids, you build up to modern institutions.
Yeah, and then you introduce the technology, it feels organized. But I want to push back on whether this delayed introduction undercuts the very premise that AI is deeply woven into our evolutionary trajectory. Because the author is aiming for a thesis of human-AI co-development.
Right, so holding the primary technological protagonist in the wings until the final act creates a really disjointed reading experience.
It really does. You're reading this, like, dense book about evolutionary biology for 4 parts, and then suddenly you just get hit with an alien invasion of artificial intelligence in part 5.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. If you don't weave the AI through line early on, you undercut the entire premise. The whole point is that AI is deeply woven into our evolutionary trajectory, not just some sudden break from it.
Right, so that segregation is a problem. The suggestion here is that you have to thread the concept of responsive symbolic infrastructure much earlier in the text.
So, like, using the biological externalizations discussed in the early chapters as direct, side-by-side structural parallels to modern AI?
Yes, exactly. You need to prime the reader for the ultimate technological synthesis.
Okay, let's break that down with some concrete examples.
Sure. Let's look at chapter 5, where the manuscript details the grandmother hypothesis.
Right. The idea that post-reproductive human females were an evolutionary advantage because they served as this living exosomatic capacity, preserving rare event knowledge and social memory.
Exactly. But right now, it's just presented as a straight anthropological fact. To weave the AI theme in, the author should explicitly, and briefly, mind you, preview how a large language model acts as an artificial parallel for that exact archive of human language.
Oh, wow, that's an interesting pivot. So you don't need to dedicate 10 pages to AI in Chapter 5?
No, not at all. You just drop a comparative anchor. You basically say, you know, look at how the grandmother functioned as a biological server for the tribe's data, and now keep that in mind for when we discuss algorithmic memory banks later on.
I love that. And there's another opportunity when introducing Terence Deacon's inverse Darwinism.
Oh, right. The relaxed selection idea?
Exactly. The text introduces the idea that early human regulation was offloaded to caregivers, which relaxed the evolutionary pressure on internal biological maintenance.
Yeah, their brains didn't have to work as hard to survive because the community was buffering them.
Right, so you can draw an immediate parallel there to the cognitive offloading and the second self-domestication that's currently happening with AI. Note that these are just a couple of ways to integrate the AI theme earlier to build a cohesive narrative arc.
Yeah, show the reader that the relaxed selection happening around a Pleistocene campfire is structurally identical to the cognitive offloading happening when someone uses a large language model to synthesize a research paper. Don't wait until part V to make that connection.
It creates a completely different reading rhythm. You actively train the reader to view biology and technology through the exact same lens simultaneously.
Moving from how the technological argument is structurally integrated, though, we really have to examine how confidently the foundational biological arguments supporting it are presented. Which brings us to our second point.
Yeah.
The relentless deployment of defensive caveats around contested evolutionary frameworks interrupts the narrative momentum and inadvertently weakens the manuscript's authoritative voice.
The author is exceptionally rigorous here. I mean, they go so far as to grade evidence from A to E, which is a cool move for transparency, but...
But the weakness is that it translates into continuous in-text hedging.
Exactly. Every single time a major concept like the grandmother hypothesis, cooperative breeding, or self-domestication is introduced, the prose just hits the brakes to apologize or deflect. It's saturated with phrases like, this is debated, or this doesn't mean matriarchy, or we shouldn't romanticize.
Right. And this constant defensive posture completely bogs down the pacing. It dilutes the bold, integrative claims being made.
I have to ask, though, is there a risk that focusing solely on insulating the argument from every possible academic counterattack might overlook the reader's need for a cohesive, propulsive synthesis? I mean, in evolutionary anthropology, scholars are terrified of being accused of biological determinism.
It's a totally valid fear, but suffocating your own narrative isn't the solution. The text is paralyzed right now.
So how do we fix it?
The suggestion is to consolidate the defensive boundary setting and academic disclaimers. Remove the micro-hedges from the main body paragraphs and allow the primary prose to treat these concepts confidently as the integrative models the grade C inferences that they actually are.
Okay, so what does that look like in practice? Give me a concrete example.
Take a section exploring Rianne Esler's partnership versus domination framework. You could relocate all those extensive disclaimers about archaeological evidence not proving peaceful matriarchies to a dedicated methodological boundaries box.
Or maybe just a formalized preface.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than interrupting the flow of the actual theory, you isolate the damage control.
Oh, that makes sense. Let's try to rewrite one of these hesitant sections on the fly, like when they introduce the self-domestication hypothesis.
Yeah. Currently, the author introduces the idea that humans became less reactive, but then immediately trips over themselves to warn the reader that humans are obviously still capable of proactive violence.
So instead of immediately warning the reader, you just boldly state the dynamic as a unified mechanism. You say something like, self-domestication widened relational time by reducing reactive aggression, which ironically created the coordination required for proactive violence.
Oh, that's so much better. It removes the apologetic tone entirely while still preserving the nuance. These examples demonstrate how to maintain rigor without sacrificing narrative drive.
Exactly. Readers tackling this level of scholarship are already willing to grant the author the premises for the sake of the larger argument. They don't need to be protected from academic debate in every single paragraph.
And building that confident foundation is critical because once the narrative is streamlined, the ultimate destination of this argument, the ethical integration of AI, must land with unshakable logical necessity rather than just moral preference.
Which brings us to the final critique. The transition from descriptive evolutionary biology to the normative prescription of life-coherent AI relies on an ethical leap that could be substantially reinforced by framing it as a strict empirical mechanism for civilizational survival.
The text transitions from what was, like the empirical reality of the evolved nest, to what ought to be, which is the normative proposal of life coherence for AI governance.
Right.
And the weakness is that, to a skeptical or highly technical reader, this just feels like an abrupt shift from empirical science to ethical philosophy. The causal link between denesting and civilizational collapse is present in the text, but it is currently underexploited as an empirical existential threat.
The material makes a strong case for life coherence by highlighting our developmental needs, for sure. But I turn to you here. That makes sense. But is the connection between biological nesting and technological regulation fully established as a survival imperative? Or is there a risk that readers might dismiss this as just a highly formalized moral preference?
That's exactly the risk. I mean, the text treats life coherence as this polite request for better technology, but the biology they've presented suggests something way darker. So the suggestion is to recast life-coherent AI not merely as a great normative proposal, but as a structural biological necessity.
To prevent that denesting cascade from destroying the human cognitive architecture the AI relies upon.
Exactly. Ground the ethics and the evolutionary mechanics already established in the text.
So how do we make that a hard empirical threat? Let's get some concrete examples of how they could do that.
Well, you can utilize Carl Friston's free energy principle, which is actually already introduced in the manuscript, to argue that non-life coherent AI will trigger a fatal self-evidencing loop of institutional denesting. You treat this as a systemic collapse rather than just an ethical failure.
Oh, right. So let's put that in plain English for a second. We're talking about the danger of hallucinated homeostasis. Like the AI acts as a digital pacifier, giving the brain the chemical reward of feeling cared for.
Or the illusion that we have all the right answers.
Yeah, but without any of the actual friction or struggle or growth of a real human relationship.
Exactly. And you can also explicitly frame the second self-domestication as a biological risk. Detail how if AI replaces cooperative care and unstructured play, human neurological plasticity will physically adapt to chronic deprivation.
Because plasticity just means you adapt to whatever environment you're in, right?
Right. So if the environment is a frictionless AI interface, the brain adapts to a relationally thin world, leading to populations physically incapable of mature democratic participation.
Wow.
This shows the reader that nest-compatible AI is an empirical requirement for the continuation of the species, which is just one way to elevate the stakes of the final argument.
That is such a powerful shift. It forces the reader to confront the biological consequences of their code. It's no longer a moral luxury, it's a survival imperative.
Totally.
Okay, we've covered some intense structural ground today. Let's briefly summarize our three high-level takeaways. First, structurally weaving the AI premise into the early biological chapters so it doesn't feel like a sudden rupture in Part V.
Second, consolidating the academic caveats into boxes or prefaces to empower the authoritative voice and keep the narrative momentum going.
And finally, grounding the normative life coherence AI ethics in strict empirical survival mechanisms like the denesting cascade. Implementing these actionable suggestions will transform the material from a rigorous academic synthesis into a propulsive, urgent framework for the future of human development.
Couldn't agree more.
We invite the listener to implement these structural and thematic changes and submit their revised material back to the critique for further review. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.